basic method just to try and go on to my left, right? That's the direction that I'm going. I'm going right there.
You go through the door, and then you go through that little door that's opposite. And then you go to the right.
Oh, wait a second. Are you going to go? The stair you're used
to? No.
So you go up to the door, and you go up the stairs. Right?
Which stairs? Which
stairs? The door up to the floor.
I know. It's under. Yeah. But now, what do I do when I walk in?
Follow that railing.
Okay, you are.
Yeah.
we have a chance. You were going on any trips today?
I didn't go, but my wife took two of our grandchildren to that English line for the Holy Land Museum, whatever it was, that they had to go. And before they went there, they took them to some kind of memorial for the Holocaust, somewhere out there, Route 38, someplace. They went there also.
There's a trip
to Camp Roosevelt. Really? I didn't see it advertised. Why did we eat the matzah before the maror? Because the maror seems to be like the introduction to the matzah. We eat the matzah before the maror, because matzah is a India rice maror.
Could be a
reason.
It's a
bonus.
Yeah.
I saw somewhere.
Well, the only question is, I don't think that's a character, because the evidence is, even this man Hamikdash, we ate matzah before the maror.
It's not finished, we can together, no?
Well, according to Hill, you can together. But then there's some that create them separately from matzah, so that's first. The Rambam describes Hill Seder.
But if Hill were eating today, we would also eat the matzah and the maror separately. According to most of the
Shiddas, that depends how your goal race is.
Because the matzah and the rabbana and the derisa, and you take away the top, you take
from
the
rabbana. That's right. In other words, we have to catch. Otherwise, let's just do Korach, since the Chachamim say Korach is okay.
Yeah.
The answer is, since Matzah is derisa, the maror rabbana would be rabbana.
Okay,
you
live in Yerushalayim? No, I live in the Boca Raton, Florida.
Oh,
so you spoke at our shul, you came
down. Yeah.
Your brother spoke also.
He opened up Aliyah,
so I had your brother as a scholar of residence also.
So you're stuck, so you didn't have a minyan for you? You didn't have a second
baby?
I don't.
So we spend the Seder with my son, who's in Baca. He lives regularly in Baca. They're here visiting now, the people suffer. So we spent the Seder by there, and then yesterday we came here to be with my wife's children. Because
very nice. Very nice.
I spent this year in Boca in our shul, so we have little classes in the season, like from the beginning of December until March, the so-called Florida season. So we try to set up classes every day, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, every day from like 10 to 12, at least, if not 10 to 1, whatever we can find, somebody who wants to give a shiur or step on a regular basis. Yeah. So we've been pretty successful in having some very, very, you know, good classes go on. Mm-hmm. This year I gave a class myself. I gave a class on the Haggadah, I decided. So it took
how many
me,
weeks is that right?
So I'm telling you, it took me, I gave from December 17th, I came late to plot, December 17th, until March 30th, every Wednesday for an hour from 10 to 11, and I just made it to Shulchan Aruch.
Okay.
I just got through the first half of
my
brother.
That's wonderful. There is really a thorough treatment. Very few, I got a shiur in my
I was using a bunch of sword. Primarily, I was using the Malden, and the Abu Dhabi, but I had a lot of other sources. The rugs, that came out with the rugs.
Yeah, they have two different ones of
rugs. Yeah, I saw a couple.
It's interesting. I have read that there are more enforcement on the Haggadah than on the Kumash. Unbelievable.
Everybody has seen.
Every
Maral, you mentioned Maral.
Yeah, every year there are 25
new ones. Yeah. They came out this year with a gather from Raboshi, that somebody collected the things
he said.
They
didn't write about that.
They collected the name.
Yeah, amazing. So the Malamagad was also a little bit of a story. I don't remember all the details, but not so clear that it's directly from Bob.
Yeah, I saw somebody that said that, but somebody that said that. I mentioned over Kamenetsky, I always get a kick out of telling my family and what have you, come to this business of Kibrochs and Mishkibrochs. But Yaakov did not eat Kibrochs because of a nether that he made when he was Labotka that time, but everybody in the family ate them. For him, they kept separate dishes.
It was like it was an excuse, he didn't want to embarrass
them. Yeah, the and then practice. he held his
and said, once he said it, he
had to. Yeah, he wanted to keep them intact. But he saw nothing wrong, you know, with Kibrochs.
Correct.
He couldn't start with that.
I'm sorry. I am a minute late, but I was just finishing off the daf on the computer.
Who do you listen to on the
computer? Rabbi Leibowitz.
Yeah, I listen to Rabbi Grossman.
Sorry, I'm late, Rabbi.
Yeah.
I know it's cold and late, but I've been working the whole day. Forget all this. Some work just to make money. I'm calling them away, but I have to feel self-conscious about it because it's Moed. It's not just cold.
Sugar, one other thing that in Eretz Yisrael you get more attention. Kutzlar is unfortunately. Even among Orthodox.
But even in some neighborhoods, like in my Kew Garden Hills, there was a store that was open Chol Moed, but he had the shutters half down. It's a real hecker that it was.
One door is open, one door is closed.
I wish I worked all day. It was nice to open it.
We're at the bottom of the mountain legs.
Okay, now again, you have to remember, a little bit, that right after the two dots, the Gemara right above this, the case was she was Miskatcha. Right, the first case was.
That's two dots, further down.
Further down.
Here. Okay, the truth of the matter is, let me start with the two dots.
That's Mukhagan, so
the two Gemaras are connected, so. We'll get back to the two dots. She was Ms. Kadeshes of the consent of her father, so it's Kedushin Doraisa. Baha'u'llah, Kabilam Dinas Yom, but her father is not here, Baha'u'llah, Benisis. And she went and she had Nisuin without the father's consent, but we don't know what the father would agree to or not. That would mean, in other words, she allowed her husband to be machnis her into the bias, as opposed to the father giving it over. So the question is, she's Banai and Arusa, because the father was entitled, the father agreed to the Kedushin. The question is she upgraded to a Nisua? So Amar Rav, Eichelos Petruma, we go with the assumption that the father would be maskim to the Nisuan, since he was maskim to the Erisin. Therefore, she can eat Truma as a Nisua, ad sheyava yaviya v'yimcha, until the father comes back and protests. In other words, our operating assumption is the father would be Nicha, but Lamaisa, he can't protest. Ravasi Amar, well, if he could protest, Eino Achelis, we cannot let her eat Truma, Shema Yavo Aviyah V'Yimcha, And if the father is oker, then the suin, she's only an arusa, and a zora, a non-bas kohen, cannot eat from her. And again, let me just remind you that min ha-taira, as long as she's an aishas kohen, she is allowed to eat truma. An arusa does eat truma. It's only a drabbanan that an arusa doesn't eat truma. Shema tashka, lest she'll
give it to her family.
Right. So the issue here, by definition, is only an iser drabbanan, because at worst she's only an arusa. But nevertheless, Rav Asi is choshesh that maybe the father will be mokan serin. And then it says havayufta, there was a maisa shahaya, that the katana was miskatsha midas avia, and then the father went away, and the nesuin was shalom midas avia v'chashla l'rav l'hadu Rav Asi. And Rav was choshesh to Rav Asi's view and did not allow her to eat truma. This is a tremendous anivus, that even though Rav held it was mutter, and Rav was actually bigger than Rav Asi, but in deference to Rav Asi, he was choshesh with that view. Now, then we say, Omar of Shmuel bar of Yitzchak, and Moder Rav, even though Rav holds meikar adin, she can eat truma on the assumption that she's a nesua, in Mesa, if she dies before the father came back, but at this point his conflict of interest, he's not going to come back and now say, oh, I like the Nisuan, because there'll be mobs of the original going to go to that, right? So in such a case, we don't assume he was Moskin, and therefore the husband will not inherit, and the inheritance will go to the father, because of the principle of Uki Mamonda B'cheskes Mare, that we leave money, we leave property in the possession of the prior person
so
entitled to it.
So
well, that's good.
She was a thistle.
Right. Well, yeah, for some purposes, it's a split thing. For some purposes, Rav says, we can treat her like a Nesua. For Yerusha purposes, we have to treat her like an Arusa, because of the principle of Hamosi Michavero Allah Haraya. Okay. Now, case number two. Case number two is Niskat Sholadas. It starts off the same. The Kedushin was with the consent of the father. Vinissa Shalovadas, the Nesuan was without the father's consent. The Abiya Khan. But instead of the father being in Medina Sayam, the father is here. Now, if he would protest, for sure it's no good. And if he would say it's fine, for sure it is good. The case here is, the father did not say anything. He gets informed, Mazel Tov, your daughter is now a Nesua, and he doesn't say anything. So how do I treat it at that point? No, Arusa she is for sure, because the father was Makabo Kedushin. But she went ahead and made Nisuin without getting his consent.
That's the whole thing, the chuppah and everything.
Well,
in those days,
that would be the chuppah, that would be the bringing her home. The chuppah is a symbolic home. Erickson was just the ring ceremony. That's all it was. It used to be separated.
Like a year.
It was separated by a year. That was the common situation. But as much as that, we do it all the same time. Actually, it's interesting that the Rishon who is credited, the one who's credited with the beetle of the custom of a year, is Rashi. Is it the Tekunin of Rashi?
That late?
Yes, that late. To be Mubatel. And you may not have been the first one, but as a standard Pesach Halacha, Rashi says it's not Macham today to wait a year because of the morality and various other concerns. Okay. So the difference between this case and the earlier case, is the father was in Medina Sayam. Here the father is present and he's Shachan. So how do I interpret? That's the question. How do I interpret Shtika? Rav Huna Omar, Eino Ocheles. She Vadai cannot eat Truma. The Gemara will explain why. Rav Yirmi Amar Abba Amar Ocheles. Rav Huna Omar, Eino Ocheles, meaning like this. Avi Lula Rav Yamar Ocheles. Even Rav, who when the father is not here, we assume his consent. And she could eat Truma. Asamu, only there do I assume consent. The low Isoliyah, because the father's not here, we assume if he wanted his daughter to be married, to be an Arusa, he'll also want her to be a Nesua. Abul Haba, the father is here. Why isn't he saying Mazel Tov? Why isn't he affirmatively agreeing? It must be. This is the opposite of Shtika Kalanda. We don't say he agreed. The other way around. The normal affirmative response would be, Mazel Tov, I'm so happy. He's stonily silent. I the ishtim, mir shakrasa.
he's quiet because he is so angry and upset. He doesn't allow himself to say a word. So this is actually worse. The father being here and not saying anything is worse than if he wouldn't be here at all. That's the first opinion. The other way around. By people the Rav Asi, even like Rav Asi said, that when he's not here, he can't eat, because we assume the chashash that maybe he'll protest. If he's here and he doesn't protest, we go with the idea of shtika, the hotel, right? So there's two opposites for it. Apilu the Rav Asi, the Amar, Enu Ocheles, Hasamu, the Shema Yavoa via the Yimchem. Abul Hacha, Mida Shasak, if he did keep quiet, he didn't protest. Isnuche, Isnichovai, he's accepting it. Shtika, Kahayda. But that's the question. Do you interpret silence here as a sign of anger, or silence as a sign of acquiescence, even grudging acquiescence and admission?
So why not ask?
Yeah, so that's the question. The question is, how long does this go on? If I interpret his initial silence as acquiescence, then even if he says later that I'm against it, we would treat that as changing his mind. And if he doesn't, if he's not mocha immediately, we would already interpret that as.
That's fine for that shita. But for the other shita that says initially, his anger is what's keeping him from responding.
So what if he says he's not angry? It could be maybe in that case it might be shayach that could validate the nesuah. The machlokas is only when initially he didn't say yes and now he says no. Do I allow the no to be consistent with his shtika, or is it inconsistent with his shtika? Okay, so now we have a third case. And this is a mudna case. This is Niskatsha Shalola Dasavia. Now this is the original Kedushin was not Midasavia. So the father did not agree to it, or at least he did not authorize the original Kedushin. And she went ahead and did an Asuin without her father. So her father did not consent to anything, but her father is here.
So she's a Ketana.
Yeah. So here the question becomes, are you going to say shtika kahoda on this? See, in the earlier case, the father had agreed to the kedushin, so we had a machlokas. Do I say shtika kahoda on the nesuah? Here, am I going to allow shtika kahoda on where both the kedushin and the nesuah were not done with his consent? So here, Rav Kuna says, strangely enough, Ocheles, the mother's going to ask him this.
No.
She could eat truma. Now, okay, you'll see in a second. Rabbi Yirmiyah Amar Abba Amar Eino Ocheles. Now, Amar Ula says on this last case, Padre Rav Kuna Kechomech V'Shinayim V'Cha'ashan Mi'anah. This is a phrase from Mishle. Rav Kuna's halakha here is inexplicable. It is like vinegar to the teeth, right? If you ever have vinegar, your teeth are at edge, and like smoke in your eyes. Because remember, in the case where the father agreed to the erusin, like the case
he says law,
right? But he didn't. He was chasing under the suet. Rav Kuna said maybe his shtick is because he's angry. So the question is, if even where he agreed to the marriage, making the kedushin d'oraisa, I still say he wouldn't agree to the suet. Then how's the homer when she did everything on her own? How could Rav Kuna say when she did everything on her own? Will interpret the shtika kahoda. If anything, that would make him more angry. That would make him more upset. She went and got married without his permission. Hashtel ma hasod kedusha d'oraisa. In the case where she's niskatsha l'dasa via, so the kedushin is minatayre for sure. Nevertheless, if the nesuin was done without the father's consent. Loi achla, we don't let her eat truma because the father's shtika is construed as an anger. When the etzem kedushin was not with the father's consent, well, kolshiken, of course the father's angry. So how could Rav Kuna be more mekel? And therefore, Ula concluded, nirin divrei Talmud. The Talmud of Yirmiyah Bar Abba is a Talmud of Rukhuna. Therefore, it appears to me, Ula says, that the words of Yirmiyah Bar Abba that she's not a Kavah is more Mishtabra. Rav Huna's halacha is difficult to understand. But nevertheless, Rava gives us an explanation. Yeah, Kavah Ben Rav. Yeah, we'll try to get a little extra coverage here. Sorry, Marivan. Omar Rava, my time with Rav Huna. Why is Rav Huna Mechalek? So hayo v'nasa v'amaisa yisayma b'chaya. Yisayma b'chaya of, in its technical sense, is where the father married her off and there was nesuin. That's where the father married her off. So if she's an almana or a grusha from nesuin, she's no longer in the reshus of her father, and the father can no longer marry her off. Now, the pure case of yisayma b'chaya is when the father himself did everything. This, however, is similar to the Maisa. This is an action of emancipation in the sense that she went so far not only to do Erison, but also to do a Misura. So here is the Svara. Rav Huna's Svara is that at some point her behavior exhibits so much independence that he surely would not have contained himself had he been upset. Meaning, when does Rav Huna say he's going to keep quiet but be angry? That's when he did the Erison, and she just did one step, she did the suing. But when she does Erison and the suing, without even asking him, that is such an outrageous assertion of independence from her father that he would not have been able to hold himself in. Mimela shtika shehai dar. And the other say, it's as if, in other words, it is as if she is declaring she doesn't have a father. So this is not a technical Yisayim of Chaya. If he's making a declaration, so on that, Yuvar, I have to say, he would have been Sabeyah.
And also, halakhically, because she becomes a Yisayim of Chaya.
At this point, yes.
At this point,
yes.
He can't marry her anymore.
That's correct, because at this point, he's masked into the Nisuan. So now it morphs into a real Yisayim of Chaya. Right, okay. All right. So now we go right to what this is. Remember the whole sugya here, are different Hei Tzimtzis about a katana and the Kabbalah's Kedusha, which in our Torah wouldn't be good unless the father was Maskil. So Itmar, katana shniskacha shlo dasvi. Let's say the katana was the Kabbalah's Kedusha without her father's consent. So it's a davar pasha that we said the father can say no. The father can say no, and you mabaka the Kedusha. But what about this? Amar Rav, Bein hi, Bein aviyah, Yechayman ma'akeh. Now, the Rishayna have a lot of difficulty. It says, not only can the father say no, but she can say no as well. Now, the Rishayna say, well, yes, the Rishayna say the Feirish. This doesn't mean she can say no after the father said yes. If the father said yes, she's now locked into a Kedushin in Atola, and there's no way that the father, that she could then leave by simply saying, I don't want. But the point that we're making is...
That's not what happened for the wrong group.
Okay, I don't know. It's been a long time. Okay. But here, the issue is, since it's not a Kedushin till the father says he's Maskit, so Mimela, until that point, even she can walk away. So let's say the father is in Medina Tayyam. So we don't know what the father would do. At that point, she can walk. She can walk away. She has the right to walk away as well, without a get, like me, without a get.
We say Shema Misratza Ha'av.
Yeah.
So that's only from the time?
So that's a kasha. That's the chayra kasha, because the pashtas, you're right, this Gemara is a contradiction. If you learn that Shema Nisratza Ha'av is you have to be kosher, he had already given his consent, then Lechayre, you still have the same problem. How could she possibly walk away? So this is a raya to the other, which is actually more difficult to understand, that the Shema Nisratza is that the husband, can, I'm sorry, the father can somehow validate her action after it happened. Now the question is, how does that work? But if you learn that way, that is why until his validation, she can still walk away. Yeah, this is a riot for that shout. Now Ravasi says no. Ravasi says what she does, she's stuck with. The father has the right to invalidate her, but she is bound by her kedushin until there's an invalidation. There's always, I don't know if anyone here is a legal background, but this is Lahavdil, the secular law. This is called an estoppel, meaning she is precluded from denying the maisa that she herself did, even if the father has the kayach of being mavato.
And she has to feed the estoppel.
Right. Ravasi Yamar Aviyah Velohi, only the father can do it, she cannot do it. Then the Gemara says, how could that be so? Ace say, Ravasi, Rakuna asked Ravasi Akasha, the Amrilan, some people say, Achia Barav asked Ravasi Akasha, it says, Imma'ain, Imma'ain Aviyah. Now this is talking about Onesu Mafate, right? The halacha is, if a man, ma'anish, rapes a woman, or is mafate, entices a woman, so there is a halacha that says, it's strange to modern ears, that velosi elisha, the offender, must marry this woman, and he cannot divorce her. Now,
ever.
Right. But it then says,
without her consent.
Who you call the shelf of Yoma?
Oh, Yoma.
As long as he's alive.
Well, when he dies,
she
doesn't need a
divorce. Yeah, she doesn't need
a divorce.
Yeah.
Right. Could she get a divorce if she wants one in that case, or not?
Yeah, unconscious. Yeah. I mean, she cannot divorce her against her will. Oh. Against her will. Now, it then says like this, though. The Torah then says, by Mufata, Ima'ein Odia, if her father, so we're talking about a Ketan here, if her father refuses to give her to this man, which is understandable. So the halacha is, the man must pay a knas. And he still pays the knas of 50 shekel, but he doesn't marry her. Now, the Brisa says, Ainli Elavia. This tells me the father has the right of refusal. He atzma minayin. How do I know that the woman herself has the right of refusal, which is true. The woman herself could say, I don't want. So we darshan, im ma'ein, yi ma'ein, mikol makom. The double verb, im ma'ein, yi ma'ein, is marva that there's another person who can refuse. Not only the father, but also the woman herself.
Even though the father wants her to remain.
Well, yeah, even though the father at least didn't say he didn't want. Now, here's the question. The question is, now, Bechara, you might ask right off the bat, what does this have to do with our Shaila? Our Shaila is where she was mitabeles kiddushin, did she undo her action? Here, there was no maisa kiddushin. This is premarital. So, the Havamina is this way. The Havamina is, you'll see, that this is talking about, he was mafata a ketana to get married. Mafata tried to convince him. So the havamina is, it's a sure havamina, that the case of mafata was not mafata l'shem snus, but he was mafata a ketana l'shem kiddush. So essentially it's become a case of mishkatsha shalom v'das aviyah without the father's consent. And the halacha says the favorite, she would say no. So the Gemara's answer is Amar Lahu Rav. So Rav answers, isn't it? So Rav actually answers on behalf of Ravasi. Lo tizlu basar ipcha. Don't go in a crooked way. Yachol lishnuye lechu kigon shepita shalom shemisha. That you're assuming that the case was pita l'shem isha, and then you're trying to prove that she has the right to undo it. No, he was mafata her l'shem bia. So she has the right not to get married then. But it's not talking about if she agreed to marriage, can she undo it? If she agrees to marriage, Ravasi says she's stuck, only your father could undo it. But here, this was not a marriage. So frek t'gemara akasha like this. Pita shloga shemisha's rabbi? This is interesting. If we're talking about that the pitoy was not the shemisha, then do I need a pasuk? Of course, then the father could say no and she could say no. In other words, there would only be a chiddush in the pasuk if you're talking about undoing a kiddush. So the answer is, yes, I'm a Rav Nachman, but it's called my mother, should Mishalim Kimas be Mephutim. See, let me explain one difference. There's a filler between Onus and Mephutim. An Onus, if he marries her, he still has to pay Kinas. By Mephutim, if he marries her, he doesn't have to pay Kinas. So the Kiddush of Mephutim is, not that father and daughter have a right of refusal. That's logical, because there was no confusion. But I would have thought the Mephate could say, if I'm ready, willing, and able to marry, and it's you that don't want to marry, what gives you the right to make me take an us? It's like, you know, you're manipulating me into a situation where I got to take an us. The Kiddush and the Pasuk is, they have the right to do that. In other words, it's not that they have the right to refuse to get married, it's obvious, but they have the right to refuse to get married, even if that means the Mephate is going to have to take an honor. Even though he says, you see me, I'm ready to get married. And the like. Okay. Now, Omar Le Rabbi Yosef, Rabbi Yosef then says, this is a Siyua, Ihachi, Hainu Nitanina, and that's why the Taka says, Mahor Yimareno Lolishi shall be trotter to what? Meaning you need Kedushin. In other words, the Pito is not the same Kedushin. Shetrichai Menu Kedushin. Because in Pito of Shemishas, if we're talking about a Pito in the Shem Kedushas, why would you need a Kedushan on the lake? But Abaya says, that's not a proof, because even if it's a Pito in the Shemishas, if she's a Katana, you would need a Kedushan that the father would be Masukana. Right? So again, it's not a Raya. But nevertheless, the Masukana is clear that this is a Pito in Shalom of Shemishas.
You have a chance of getting
this. Yes, we're fine. We're at 10 lines ahead.
Are we changing anything around again? Because in the sense of the what the then.
No, just
the
Yeah, that was yesterday.
He
only announced 5 o'clock this morning.
Tomorrow morning, we'll tell you every day.
We're going to stay in the morning.
You know, people, and I don't want to, you know, again, I mean, how much I raise is wonderful, and I'm happy to do 4:30 if you want to.
No, I'm not, I just want to know.
I just want you to make up
the time. I like to finish it in the morning.
Okay. Well, that
if we don't finish, you're having a problem. The main share is
7.
I can't make it anyhow, so that doesn't matter. That's happy that you're going to be a
How many people they have?
You show me.
How many people they have in the morning?
Yeah, I had what, about 6-7 people?
Yeah, very nice size.
That's nice. They were all winning at 7.
Yeah.
Some of us were
84-7. Pretty much.
Okay. I'm happy to do whatever you want me to do. Just tell me what you want. Tell me what you want, and I'll.
How about a shift from 7 in the morning to 7:00?
Okay.
What?
Okay.
You have a white hand in the morning.
I mean, the Daf Yomi is 7 to 8, but we don't finish the Daf, so we do a little bit. So today it started at 5 o'clock. It's needed a half an hour. We're not sure. In other words, if we finish the Daf in the morning, lab Dafka, but that's under negotiation, heavy negotiation. I said whatever people want, I'll do. I just, you know. Okay. Okay. So I wanted to actually start with a little bit of a continuation of what I was talking about yesterday. Then I'll go on to something a bit new.
That is, I mentioned yesterday in the name of Reb Chaim, that Reb Chaim says there are four basic elements
that differentiates the mitzvah of Zechirat Yetzias Mitzrayim from the mitzvah of Sipur. Every single day, twice a day, day and night, there is a mitzvah to remember the Exodus verbally, and that's based on the pasuk L'man Tishkor Es Yom Seischa Me'eretz Yisrael Kael Yemei Chayecha, and that's discussed in the Haggadah itself, and that is why we say in the Shema Ani Hashem Elokeichem Asher Hotzeisi Yescha Me'eretz Mitzrayim, and even the Art Scroll Siddur will tell you you have to have kavana to be fulfilled the mitzvah of Sipur Zechiras Yetzias Mitzrayim. And then there's a special mitzvah the night of the 15th called Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim, which is derived from a totally different pasuk. And the Rambam says both of them are d'oraisa. Now there is a question, I'm not going to answer this question in particular, that is, the Rambam does seem to indicate that both Sipur and Zechira are mitzvos min ha-Torah. But when he lists the 613 mitzvos in the list, he only lists Sipur, he does not list Zechira. So you have a strange situation, and this happens in a lot of places actually, in which something could very well be a d'oraisa chiyuv, but for a technical reason, it is not listed in the minyan hamitzvos. Actually, I'll give you one. I'll give you an answer for shame of
Christ. Does he list Shema as the...
Yes, he does. Yes, Shema. Well, no, well, not really. Vayomer is not part of Shema. Vayomer got put in there only because of Zechira Yetzias Mitzrayim. So there is an answer like Rav Chaim. This is what Rav Chaim says. Rav Chaim says, you know, the Rambam wrote a work called the Sefer HaMitzvos. And the Sefer HaMitzvos is divided into three parts. There is part two is Mitzvos HaSeh. And part three is mitzvos lo sase, and that's fine. But what is part one? Part one is a very, very unique contribution that the Rambam made to the science of halacha, you might say. And that is, the Rambam started off with a very, very difficult problem. And the difficult problem the Rambam has is, Chazal gave us a tradition that there are 613 mitzvos, 248 positive mitzvos, and there's 365 negative mitzvos, and the total number is merumas in Torah Siva Lanu Moshe. Torah is Begematria 611. We heard 611 from Moshe, and the first two of the Aseret HaDibros, Anochi and Lo Yelecha, we heard from God. Okay. Now the problem is, though, Chazal didn't give us a list of what those 613 are. And if you go through every time Hashem said, do something, you're going to get a lot more than 613. You're going to get something like 5,000 imperative statements. But let's take even a single korban. When God says, bring a korban chatas, bring a sin offering. He says, you shall shecht it, you shall sprinkle the blood. You know, if you start breaking every command down, you know, why don't I count the commandments, don't eat from the Eitz Hadas as the first mitzvah? I mean, it's not on the list of the 613. Okay. So what the Rambam did was, the Rambam was the first, and really almost the only, who tried to develop classification rules. He didn't just list mitzvahs like the Bahag did and Rav Sadia Gaon, but the Rambam tried to first give you 14 principles that determine what do you count and what don't you count. For example, just to give you a simple example, the Rambam said that when a process has multiple steps, we only count the process as a single mitzvah. So the mitzvah is lahavi korban chatas. And that will include shechita and zerika, the sprinkling of the blood, etc. Or Shabbos. Shabbos has 39 malachos. But we don't count Shabbos as 39 prohibitions. Shabbos is one prohibition, you know, a positive and a negative, lo sasa. So the Rambam develops different criteria, and by the way, this is the most lumdisha part of the book, meaning the Ramban has many, many disagreements with the Rambam as to the formulations and other meforshim. This is the most lumdisha part of the Sefer HaMitzvos, and the Rambam's listings more or less follow his principles, except when they don't, and that's also all cause for trouble, that sometimes the Rambam's own formulation does not follow the principles he laid down. Okay. So in one of the principles, this is the Shorish, the third Shorish, the Rambam lays down an interesting rule that even if something is a Torah commandment, we only count it as Taryag if it's a mitzvah that is noheg ledoros, if it is a mitzvah that is supposed to apply in all generations. Now, something can apply in all generations even if it only applies when there's a Beis HaMikdash, because theoretically the Beis HaMikdash could have existed in all generations. But a mitzvah that by its own terms is supposed to expire at a certain time, even if it's a mitzvah, it is not nichnas in taryag. The example the Rambam gives is the Torah prohibits leaving the man over until the morning. That is a negative commandment. But it doesn't apply to our situation because there is no man to be left over, right? We don't have man anymore. So this is the Rambam's klal, that you only count in taryag what's called a mitzvah hanoheg ledoros. Okay, this is the Rambam. So now, says Rav Chaim, a beautiful, interesting chat, although theologically it's going to be a very problematical idea. Rav Chaim says the following. We have a machlokes ben Zoma and the Chachamim, and this is in the Haggadah itself, but it's a mission in Brachos. The Torah says, "Laman tiskor es yom seischa me'eretz Mitzrayim." You shall remember the day that you left Egypt, kol yemei chayecha, all the days of your life. The word kol, everyone remembers that, God is still fresh in our memory. Kol is extra. Could have said yemei chayecha. So what is kol coming to include? So Ben Zoma says, Yemei Chayecha would have meant the days. Kol Yemei Chayecha teaches me you must even do it at night, even though we didn't leave. That's Ben Zoma. The Chachamim say, no, you don't do it at night. You don't do it at night. But Yomim means in this existence, and Kol means even when Mashiach comes. So you would have thought, what? That the redemption of Mashiach is so great that it'll supersede the Exodus, you still have to mention. So Rav Chaim says, if you learn the Gemara in Brachos, it turns out the following. The reason why Ben Zoma uses the word kol to be marbe the night and not Mashiach, because Ben Zoma actually maintains that we are not going to mention the Exodus once Mashiach comes. And this is based on a verse in Sefer Yirmiyahu, where HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Yirmiyahu, Hine yamim boim, behold, days are coming, shelo yomar ot, people shall no longer say, Chai Hashem, asher hela eschem me'eretz Mitzrayim, you know, Baruch Hashem, who took us out of Mitzrayim. They're not going to bother with that. They're going to say, Chai Hashem, that was Makabetz, the Goliath of Mashiach. So Ben Zoma says to the Chachamim, how can you say we're going to be Masker Yitzias Mitzrayim Limot HaMashiach? We're Vadai not going to be Masker, because the miracles of Mashiach will be greater. Therefore, the call of the Torah must be including the night rather than Mashiach. The Chachamim's answer is, no. Yirmiyahu does not mean we're not going to mention Yitzias Mitzrayim at all. It just means it will be secondary to Mashiach. So it turns out, says Rav Chaim, that this is an either-or scenario. If you hold, you say it at night, then you're not going to darshan limot HaMashiach. If you darshan limot HaMashiach, you're not going to do it at night. Yes, in other words, it's a negative correlation. If kol is coming for night, you're not masker limot HaMashiach. If kol is coming for limot HaMashiach, you're not going to be masker at night. So says Rav Chaim, since the Rambam paskins, like Ben Zoma, that you're mechuyev to be masker at night, then the Rambam must understand that you're not going to be masker limot HaMashiach. Therefore, Rav Chaim says, based on the Rambam's own principle in the third Shorish, that a mitzvah that is not eternal is not counted in the Tayag, according to Ben Zoma, the mitzvah of Zechiras Yetziat Mitzrayim is not an eternal mitzvah. It's a chiyuv d'oraisa, but it's not an eternal mitzvah because it will not apply when Mashiach comes. And that is why, although it is a mitzvah, it is not in the 613 mitzvahs.
Sipur will be?
Yeah, now Sipur is, because apparently even when Mashiach comes, on the annual anniversary of the event, we will do matzah and korban pesach, but the daily occurrence will be superseded. This is a teres b'shem Rav Chaim. Now, I don't want to be marking this too much, I just want to point out that this creates enormous theological problems. You know, the Rambam himself was the formulator of what we know as the 13 fundamental principles of Judaism. Now, the Ani Ma'amin, which is the listing of those 13 principles that in most Siddurim you have after Shacharis, is actually not the Lashon of the Rambam. It's somebody, some anonymous person paraphrased the Rambam. And Yigdal as well. Yigdal is also a song that encapsulates the 13 principles. But the Rambam's 13 principles are his, in the Perush HaMishnayos, in the Hakdoma to the, well, for us it's the 11th Perek of Sanhedrin, Perek Chelek, and the Rambam happens to be the 10th Perek of Sanhedrin, in which the Rambam has an introduction to Olam Haba and Mashiach, and he talks about the principles, right? Kol Yisrael Yeshlam, every Jew has a share in Olam Haba, unless they are a heretic, etc. And the Rambam goes through the definition of an apikoros and a heretic, and he lays down 13 principles. Now, one of the Rambam's 13 principles is the eternity of the Torah, that there is no mitzvah of the Torah that will ever be abrogated or annulled. Now, this is an extraordinarily important principle, because this was one of the main arguments that Judaism had against Islam and Christianity. Because Islam and Christianity acknowledge there was a Maimed Har Sinai, and they acknowledge that God had a covenant with the Jewish people, right? They're not atheistic. They believe everything in the Torah did occur, putting aside some Islamic falsifications like Yishmael at the Akeda, but by and large. But they claim that this was superseded by an abrogation of the covenant, and in particular the abrogation of the Torah itself, although they may have been false Kiddush more than Yashkes, but whatever it is. And Judaism's response always was Nitzchias HaTorah, eternity of the Torah. Now, there was a sefer written around 150 years after the Rambam, Rav Yosef Alba, great Jewish philosopher, Sefer Oikarim. And Rav Alba sharply differed with the Rambam. Rav Alba said there are not 13 principles. He said, Rav Alba accused the Rambam, or said that the Rambam was combining some things are ikarim, their roots, shirashim, and some are anafim, branches. So for example, Rav Alba said, even something like Mashiach. The Rambam says, if one does not believe in Mashiach, the Rambam says, a person is an apikores, he is a kofar, he is a heretic, he is not within the faith community of Am Yisrael. Rav Alba said that there are not 13 principles, there's only 3 principles. And everything else are derivative or subsidiary. The 3 principles are, there is a God who created heaven and earth, Metzias Hashem. Principle number 2 is reward and punishments, that God will reward goodness and God will punish evil in some way. And the 3rd principle is revelation, Torah min haShemayim. So let's take Mashiach as an example. According to the Rambam, belief in a physical Mashiach is Ikar Emunah. According to the Rambam, belief in Techiyas HaMesim, physical resurrection, is Ikar Emunah. According to Rav Alba, he doesn't deny Mashiach. Of course he believes in Mashiach, and of course he believes in Techiyas HaMesim. But he said, let's say I'm a Jew, and I believe that God will reward good and punish evil. But I don't believe it'll be through a human Mashiach, or I don't believe in physical resurrection. I only believe in the neshama, Olam Haba. Rav Alba said, the person is a fool, the person is mistaken, the person is ignorant, but he's not a heretic as long as he has an emuna in Sechar V'Yonish. That's what Rav Alba means with Shirashim, roots versus Anafim. Mashiach and Techiyas HaMesim are branches from the root of Sechar V'Yonish, but they themselves are not Shirashim. As opposed to the Rambam, right? The Rambam says very, very clearly, it is an absolute Ikar Emunah. So people misunderstand Rav Alba. So for example, Rav Alba will bring a lot of mamorim that indicate that Mashiach doesn't have to come. People sometimes read the book totally wrong. They think Rav Alba didn't believe in Mashiach. Chas v'shalom. Rav Alba is differentiating between stupid beliefs and heretical beliefs. Meaning, Rav Alba was saying, not every mistake a person makes a person an apikoros. By the way, that's a chiluk that we ought to learn from today as well. Now, in one of the Rambam's principles, eternity of the Torah, Rav Alba also questions that, you know, we see that mitzvos can change. And the outstanding example he brings is Zechiras Yetziat Mitzrayim, that according to Ben Zoma, is going to be Bata Limota Mashiach, based on the prophet Yirmiyahu. Now, if the Torah itself would have said, you're not going to do this in a sum, that wouldn't have been, I mean, you understand. The problem, the reason why Ben Zoma's rule conflicts with the Rambam's principle is not because it'll expire when Mashiach comes. That alone wouldn't be a problem if the Torah would have said that. But the problem is the Torah doesn't say it expires. It is the prophet Yirmiyahu through prophecy that is giving us that message. And according to the Rambam, it's not possible to allow a later prophet to limit the reach of the Torah. So this is a big kasha. Yeah.
Who says eternity doesn't stop? Well, this, if we say it doesn't continue after into Yemos HaMashiach.
Right, right. So the morale, that's very good. So as I say, so for Rav Chaim to say that the Rambam himself subscribes to the idea that we're not going to be Maskir Yemos HaMashiach would put the Rambam himself in contradiction with his own principle. But again, there are many, many answers. This is a complicated question. The Maharal himself discusses the question, and one answer the Maharal gives is that eternity of the Torah does not necessarily have to mean forever, ever, ever, but it means in this world. The Biyat HaMashiach is called Olam Chadash, Bria Chadasha. And because it's a Bria Chadasha, there may be different rules after Mashiach than before Mashiach. But again, the matter needs much limud. This was kind of just an aside. But what I want to get back to is the other point Rav Chaim made is, and that is, Zechira is every day, Sipur is once a year, but what is Sipur adding to Zechira? You already have to talk about the Exodus. Had there not been a mitzvah of Sipur, I would have to talk about the Exodus. So Rav Chaim mentioned, you'll recall, four distinctions, Rav Chaim and the Brisker Rav mentioned four distinctions between Sipur and Zechira. Distinction number one is Shelo Tshuva. Leil Seder, it must be a question and an answer process, not just a statement. Number two, Maschil Bignus, begin with the bad and culminate with the good. That's unique to Sipur, not Sechira. Number three, which was I talked about yesterday, the need to explain Pesach Matzah Morah, which is not the rest of the year, it's only Leil Pesach. And number four was added by the Brisker Rav, that the whole year I just remember what Hashem did. Leil Pesach, Chayav Adam, Liros Es Atzmo, I must experience. Right, so this is important. So Rav Chaim says there are four structural features that differentiate Sipur from Zechira. She'ela Utshuva, Maschil Bignus, beginning with the degradation, Pesach Matzamoror, and Chayav Adam, Liros Es Atzmo. So yesterday we explained, at least for a while, the symbolic meanings of Pesach Matzah Morah. Now I just want to briefly add some perspectives on the other elements here. Again, we go with the Baal HaTanya's idea that Mitzrayim has a double meaning. Mitzrayim is, of course, the nation of Egypt that enslaved us. But Mitzrayim also means my limits, my constrictions, my blockages, my Meitzarim, all of those things that prevent me from being connected to Hashem, my sinat chinam, my gaiva, my arrogance, my selfishness, my egotism. Chametz, of course, is a remez to all of those things. And the chayav adam liros es atzmo, the Baal HaTanya says, is you have to identify your inner slavery. And through the koach of Yetzias Mitzrayim, you can become liberated. So now, let's go back to this idea that the elements tie into this personal journey that a person has to make. Shela u'tshuva. This is very vital. In order for a person to spiritually grow, you have to be a questioner. Now, a questioner means a seeker of knowledge. A person who doesn't say, I am what I am, and I'm not trying to enlarge or expand my horizons. In fact, that's why we say a person that's a great Talmud Chacham. Right? We don't call him a Chacham, we call him a Talmud Chacham. That's a very strange title. You call a Gadol Hador, who knows everything, and you say, what a great Talmud Chacham. Now, Talmud Chacham literally means, actually it's not even clear how to translate it exactly, is Talmud Chacham a wise student? Or is it a student of the wise? There's two ways you can translate even a phrase like that. But the one thing that's for sure is that the highest accolade that we give to a great person in Torah is we call them a Talmid Chacham. Why would I call Rabbi Yashev a Talmid Chacham? The answer is because the sign of greatness in your life is that you perpetually want to grow. You want to learn. You want to be a Talmud. You know, the story goes, there was a great rabbi, Rabbi Eliezer Silver, who came from Europe around the 1920s. He eventually became primarily Cincinnati. His son was in Harrisburg. Actually, Silver was in Harrisburg himself, but then his son became the rabbi in Harrisburg for many years. But legend has it, maybe a legend, I don't know if it's true, that his first shteller was in a New England city. I don't want to say the name because it's a little bit of Lashon Hara. And he was fired from his first rabbinical position. And the reason he was fired was because the president didn't like the fact that he was learning in the shul at night and wasting electricity. So he said, we don't need a rabbi that's wasting the electric bill.
I had that happen in Louisville.
Yeah?
Someone complained.
Somebody complained?
That
Shomer Shabbos was, it's open all night. So when Rabbi Silver said, what do you mean? I'm learning. So the president said, that's even worse. I thought we hired a rabbi who finished his education. We're not here to pay your, you know, get you through school or whatever it would be. Now, you see how absurd that is. I mean, you talk about, I can mention any Gadol, any great Talmud Chacham, but I think of Rabbi Yashiv, who, Baruch Hashem, was had Arichas Yomim till well over 100, and he had been learning Yomim Belaila, I don't know, from the age of 5, or whatever the age was, but apparently after 95 years, 96 years, 98 years, there was still enough to learn and the like. And therefore the idea of a question is, I want to know, I want to expand, I want to grow. What I am today doesn't have to limit what I can be tomorrow. What I was yesterday doesn't circumscribe what I can become today. The eternal questioner. To always ask, to always, because a question by definition is a desire to keep on going, to keep on learning. And that is really the sign. In fact, even in a secular standpoint, I don't remember the exact quote, but something about the definition of an educator, a person could have many, many degrees, but if he is not interested in continuing to learn, whatever it is, he's not really educated. The definition of an educated person, I saw this as a secular quote, is somebody who still wants to continue to grow. And that is why, in truth, there's really no such thing as a bad question if it is a sincere desire for knowledge. In fact, sometimes in our chinuch systems, I mean, there are difficulties. You know, the child might ask a question, that, you know, how do you know there's a God, whatever it is. And it may be disruptive to the class, or the Rebbe may not have an answer to the question, which is true. I mean, plenty of questions, you know, I don't have answers to. And there may be reasons why it shouldn't be discussed openly. There may be different reasons. But the question process itself is not an illegitimate question if it's done with a sincere desire to learn. Now, of course, there are two types of questions. There are questions with question marks at the end, and there are questions with exclamation points at the end. And those are not really questions. Those are rhetorical, hostile statements. Rav Avadya Yosef says a very, very simple pshat in the Haggadah. You know, we have the four sons. We have the Chacham, and we have the Rasha. Now, the Chacham asks a very fancy, erudite question. Chukim, Mishpatim, Eidos, he has all the classification systems, which indicates he's scholarly, and he's bright, and he's wise, and he's analytical. And the Rasha says, Ma havoda zos lechem, why are you doing it? Now, the Haggadah is very critical, really Chazal, very critical. Lachem, he says, why do you do it? You do it, I don't do it. He's saying, I don't care about this stuff. So we condemn him. We give him like a tough love answer. He says, oh, why do I do it? Because of what God did to me. Meaning with your attitude, you know, you would have been stuck there. So everyone asks the Kashif, one of the most famous questions, that if the Rasha gets condemned, because he says, Lachem, you, and not me, the Chacham also says, Asher Tziva Hashem Elokeinu Eschem, God commanded you. Which is just the historical fact that God gave the commandment to the earlier generation. So why does the Chacham get a free pass on the use of Eschem, while the Rasha gets condemned because of the word Lachem? Now there are gazillions of answers to this question. You know, the Chacham says Hashem Elokeinu, he includes. Rav Avadya says something that's really very, very simple. It says Chaval B'Haggadah doesn't say those words, and that is, if you look at the words in the Torah immediately preceding the statements, in the case of the Chacham it says Ki Yishalcha Bincha Lemor, when your son asks you. In the case of the Rasha, Ki Yomru Aleichem B'neichem, when your son tells you. Now, I wish the Haggadah would have made that point, but Rav Avadya says, if you look at the Psukim, it's very clear that the real difference between the Rasha and the Chacham is not so much the words that they say, but the attitude behind the words. Are you being hostile? Are you being accusatory? Or do you really want to know? If you really want to know, we find a way to tell you. And by the way, pedagogically, it's a very, you know, Chazal say, Lamed l'shon chalomer eni yodeh. We all should teach ourselves to say we don't know. And you know, if a child asks a parent a question, or a child asks a Rebbe, or a Talmud asks a Rebbe, and the Rebbe says, I don't know, and then, you know, says, let's go try to find out an answer. Let's look up this, and let's look up that. That's a tremendous lesson in and of itself. That does not make the Rebbe or the parent look less in the child's eyes. It's the other way around. The child absorbs from that encounter a love of learning and the idea that the Torah is infinite and we keep on trying to grow and we don't reach an age where we say, I don't have to learn anymore. And that itself is, you know, we can impart many, many lessons to children and Talmidim besides the technical information that we give them, certain attitudes towards learning and attitudes towards Torah, etc. So that's something to think about. So that is how Sheilo Tshuva connects with a person's personal journey. I remember I was once at a conference with a very, very famous academic who was controversial and kind of loved to talk a lot. So the academic literally said these words. He says, until I was 20, I had to listen. But after 20, I just talk. I don't have to learn from anybody because nobody has anything to teach me. Well, okay. You know, so, yeah.
I had the pleasure and the discomfort of reading a story from one of the children's books, let's say the Hamadiyah, the Yom Kippur. And it shows a picture of a young boy, perhaps between 5 and 8. He decided he would remove himself from the Seder and go sit outside on the steps. And why was he sitting on the steps? He was out desperately waiting for Eliyahu Hanavi.
Right.
Did you read this?
I did not.
Oh, okay. And his parents called him in at a certain point. He was crying. He said he never came. Do I do? How can I accept this? How does a parent answer that?
Yeah. Well, you know, those are very, very hard questions. You know, how do we answer it to ourselves? You know, like someone asked Rebecca Kamenetsky, what do I tell my children about the Holocaust? And Rav Yaakov said, well, what do you tell yourself about the Holocaust? Meaning, we have problems, but I think, you know, Charlie, can you cry in Yom Tov? But, you know, if a parent comes and cries with the child, say, so, you know, we are crying that we don't have Mashiach yet, that life is so difficult, there's so many sorrows from Israel, and we hope and pray that Mashiach will come. The child sees that we feel the same thing. These are not illegitimate feelings. I mean, for carrots, Kama v'kama k'delem, how many times did the Chafetz Chaim shed tears that Mashiach is not here? That's a high madrega. The child is is a very chashuv, very, very high, high level. Okay, so that's how the Shailu Tshuva fits into getting rid of your Mitzarim, going beyond your boundaries, going beyond our comfort level, as it were. All of us become, you know, without getting into too many controversial issues here, there is sometimes a difference between what you might call religious and spiritual. A person's religious and a person keeps mitzvot, and that's very, very important. Of course it's very important. That's the foundation of our connection to God. But we sometimes do it mechanically, rote. We don't seek to expand our horizons, deepen our understandings. It becomes, as the Navi said, this is obviously a very old problem because the Nevi'im talked about it. Mitzvat anashim, v'lumata, doing things out of rote. Questions, Bedafka breaks that habit. My question is, I want to go on, I want to go weiter, I want to go further. Okay. Now we then come to the second element of Rav Chaim. Beginning with the bad, right? It's not enough to talk about the good. You got to begin with the bad. And so Machlokes says the bad we're talking about, the bad of slavery, of Adamayinu, is it the bad that we were Avodah Zarah? But you got to begin with the bad. Now, and this is Li'ikuva, meaning, if you were to conduct a Pesach Seder, and you would only talk about the miracles and the redemptions, and you wouldn't talk about how bad the slavery was, you would not be Yotzei the Mitzvah. You got to begin with the bad. Why is that so? So there are two explanations. The first explanation is very simple, but very true. The Rambam offers it. The Rambam simply says, it is human nature that we appreciate blessing only when we've been through the opposite. This is human nature. We appreciate health very often. Only if, God forbid, we've been through sickness or we've lost our health. Then we appreciate it. That is why people that are Holocaust survivors or people who have come from oppressed countries tend to be much more patriotic when they come to a free society, whether it's the United States or whether it's Israel or any country that has liberty. If you were born in a free country, you don't feel it so much. It's the nature of a person. In fact, the Chovas HaLevavos uses this as a famous mashal. The Chovas HaLevavos says, imagine if you were born in India in rampant poverty, and you were starved and you were beaten, and one day a benefactor comes and takes you to a country and gives you luxuries and all the food that you want and all the comfort that you want, how much gratitude you would feel. But Nebuch, if you were born in that very environment and you never went through, you should actually be more grateful. And yet, we take it for granted. So the Rambam says, Pashut, in order to feel the gift of Hashem redeeming, I need to think and imagine how bad the slavery was. So according to the Rambam, it's a before and after picture. That's why you have to be Maskul Bignas, a Messiah Bishvach. But there is a kasha on that understanding. Because it is HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself that decreed we would have to go through the hardship. I mean, the example would be, let's imagine I threw you in jail. And then I released you earlier than I told you I was sentencing you for. Are you going to be grateful to me for releasing you? Or are you going to say, why did you put me in jail to begin with? Meaning, it was Hashem that decreed the avdus. How can that be a basis of gratitude? So because of this, the Sifrei Chassidus say, there is a deeper yesod in Maschil Bignus and Messiah Bishvach. It's not remember the bad so you appreciate the good, but to understand that even in the bad, even in the negativity, even in the adversity, there are hidden lights of redemption for which to be grateful. In other words, Yetzias Mitzrayim didn't simply restore us to the antecedent situation that we were. It's not that we were free, we were slaves, we were free. If that's all it did, we would have resentment. Why did I go through that? But rather, the freedom that we got after the slavery was qualitatively different than what we had before. Now, how is that so? So, there are many, many perspectives on this, but one perspective is that we know that Chazal say that the Jewish people in Mitzrayim, although they were in the 49th level of Tumah, they didn't change their names, they didn't change their language, they kept a certain sense of unity and cohesiveness. The Beis HaLevi raises an interesting question. how can Chazal say they kept achdus and cohesiveness? There is a medrash that says, right, there is a medrash that says that when Paro died, I'm sorry, when Yosef died, the Shvatim and their descendants said, if we were so matzliach and so successful in Egyptian society, when we were keeping distinct minhagim, why don't we become more and more like the Mitzrayim? And they will love us more, and we will be accepted even more. So the Medrash says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu sent an evil Paro who did not remember Yosef or anything that Yosef did to prevent the Jewish people from trying to assimilate into Egyptian culture. So the Beis Halevi says, which one was it? Were the Jewish people assimilating or were they remaining distinct? The Beis Halevi says, they were in the process of assimilation. And it was precisely the persecution of the Mitzrayim that made them realize we will never be accepted. And the Beis Halevi goes through, as many, many Sfarim have done, many Rabbanim have done over the years, many Gedolim have done over the years, that when Jews want to become too close to the values of a non-Jewish culture, the non-Jewish culture will spit them out as if to tell them, if you don't realize that you have to be different or distinct or unique, we will make you realize that. And this was a gift. The slavery of Mitzrayim, as difficult as it was, gave us a sense of achdus, of unity, of distinction. Right? What did Bilaam say when Bilaam tried to curse us? And Hashem changed the curse of Bilaam into a bracha. Hein am levadot. They are a nation that stands alone. Now this is the eternal conflict of the Jewish people. Soloveitchik used to connect it to the pasuk when Avram said, Ger v'toshav, right? Avram said to Ephraim in Hebron, when he had to buy the Marat HaMachpelah to bury Sarah. So Avram prefaced it with a statement, Ger v'toshav anochi machem. I am a stranger and a resident. And in some ways, it's a contradiction. A ger, yeah, it doesn't mean convert over there. It means ger, I'm a stranger. I really don't belong here. And Rav Soloveitchik used to say that this is the eternal dichotomy of the Jew. On one hand, we are a toshav. We live wherever we live. And we contribute. Right? Jews are not like, I don't want to get into any group libeling, but they're not like cultures that simply create their own enclaves and are not involved in society at all. We contribute. We add value to any society that we're in. We care about the welfare of all. But at the same time, a Jew also has to feel like a ger, that this is not my true place. Right? So, therefore, the Beis Halevi says that one of the blessings of slavery was it gave us that sense that we have to be different. And that was a bracha. There's a second aspect. The Torah says more than 30 times you have to love the ger, the one who converts to Judaism, love the ger. And in one of the psukim it says, love and take care of the ger, ki gerim hayisem v'yaretz Mitzrayim. Now here, even though ger means a convert, but obviously it doesn't mean because you were converts in Mitzrayim. You have to go back to the meaning, the literal meaning of ger, stranger. A non-Jew converts to Judaism, came to a culture which was foreign to them. They had no relatives, they had no connection, they had no property. They were on the bottom of the totem pole. What is the Torah telling the Jewish people? When you're ensconced in your land, you're comfortable, you're powerful, you're wealthy, and you have people of insignificance, or seemingly insignificance, who come to you, don't treat them like riffraff or garbage. Remember, you were once like that. You were slaves. Remember your suffering. Remember your humiliation. Remember your embarrassment and use it as the key to empathy and compassion for those who are suffering. Psychologically, this is a remarkably profound statement. Because when people have been through in their life, you know, we live in a society, Western society generally, where everybody is a victim of one thing or another. In fact, even lawyers in the United States are trying to create a special protected group, like hate crimes, you know, like you have blacks and Asians. So lawyers are like, you know, we are victims of hate crimes because society looks at us in such a low way. Now, when a person deals with pain, there are two ways they can deal with it. One way is they develop an inner shell of toughness in which they will never allow themselves to be hurt again. You know, and all of their strengths, so to speak, are turned into developing a protective shell so they will not get hurt. And they want to distance themselves from the pain. The Torah is suggesting, now sometimes that is necessary, sometimes it is necessary, but the Torah is suggesting that the real way a person deals with psychological pain, abuse, negativity, is by not forgetting it, but connecting to it, remembering what the feelings were like, and using that as the source of empathy and compassion and concern and rachamim. Remember the friendless scare, because you were once that person. It's not an I versus them. That person was me, and therefore I look at him the way I would look at myself. So this is a gift. Again, it's an awesome gift. It's a gift that comes from persecution and the like. And the truth of the matter is, again, I don't want to get too political, even when Jews wander very, very far from the Torah, it is often this value, distorted, misused, misapplied, abused, that leads them to make the political decisions people make. Why are so many Jews involved in democratic, liberal politics? Part of it is the belief, again, I'm not going to address the merits of it, that one party is more compassionate than the other. And Jews are compassionate people. Why were so many Jews involved in the very, very wrong turn called communism? It came, right, from a real desire to help the oppressed. Even in East, I live right on the boundary of East Jerusalem, Highway 1, or Sameach is in the center of the action, so to speak. And every Friday we see people who are demonstrating for a pretty crazy, crazy cause of different rights of Palestinian terrorists or whatever it would be. And of course, this is a shtus for Hevel, and you know, very destructive and demoralizing. And I'm not, please don't assume that I'm defending that. As I denounce it and I'm against it. But I will say that it comes from a certain feeling within a Jewish soul, even if it's distorted and even if it's being applied in the wrong place, that when people in the world are suffering in any way, I want to stand up. Again, it's a Jewish value that gets perverted, but it still emanates from a Jewish heart. And therefore, you see the inner meaning, going back to the main point. The yesod of maschil bignus umisayem b'shvach is not remember the bad so that you appreciate the good, but rather to see in the adversities of life the redemptive potentials. To see that even in the so-called bad, there is so much I can learn and grow from those experiences. And therefore, in a sense, I take the darkness of the past and I reframe it as the basis of my connection to God. Like you put a different frame on it, a different view. You actually redefine the past as a source of positivity, a source of strength. And the truth of the matter is, if this is the general lesson of Maschil Bignus, this is a lesson that applies to our lives as individuals as well. Many of you may know or have heard of Rabbi Seth and Sherry Mandel, if you remember the story. that their son Kobe was actually, the Zichrono Livracha, Hashem Yinkum Dama, was actually a very good friend of my son. And a number of years ago, he and the classmates were brutally murdered in Tekoa by some heroic big shot that took two 12-year-old boys and rammed their skulls with sharp rocks until they both died. It takes a lot of courage to do something like that. And one can imagine, maybe we can't imagine, what the Mandels felt like. I mean, Baruch Hashem, they had to have other children, but still such a tragedy. Sherry told me she could not get out of her mind what her son was experiencing those last minutes. I don't want to, you know. Again, the one thing I told her, which may be a drop in the bucket of comfort, is the Shalah HaKadosh writes that when someone is murdered al Kiddush Hashem, they do not feel pain as their neshama goes back to their creator. But be it as it may, one could understand that on some level they literally lost the desire to live, to be consumed with so much grief. And yet we know that what they did was, eventually, they turned their grief into a tool for helping hundreds, if not thousands, of families. They established a foundation in memory of Kobe, and that provides, you know, financial, psychological aid to families that have been victimized by terrorism. We have summer camps and retreats. Sherry herself has written two books about living with a broken heart. And how, this is exactly, really, I mean, I cannot say it better than her, how taking the adversity and the greatest tragedy of their life and turning it into a source of light and a source of hope. And of course, unfortunately, that's not—it's not unique in Eretz Yisrael, especially if you look at the three families that lost their children in Gaza, and the message that they gave us, and the tragedies after that. I mean, we should see less and less of it, but unfortunately, we have so many examples of people who take the most difficult situations that a human being can go through, and instead of being broken by, they grow from it and they become sources of inspiration. Now, if you would ask them, would you prefer the other way? Well, of course, we would have preferred the other way. Hashem, for reasons we don't understand, didn't do it the other way. But given the reality of what is put into our lives, what do we choose to do with it? Rav Soloveitchik used to put it this way. The issue of why do bad things happen to good people? Theodicy. Tzadik v'ra'lo. Rasha v'tov lo. Rav Soloveitchik used to say, this cannot be approached as a theological question. It can only be approached as a halachic question. What does he mean by that? Theology asks, why did God do this? He says, that's an unanswerable question. Moshe asked Hashem. And Hashem said, "V'chanosi eis asher achon, I have grace to who I want to be gracious to. V'richamti eis asher arachem, meaning, I'm not telling you, Moshe. The book of Eov, big, big book, hard book, goes through all of this. But if you go to the end of the book, you actually see there is no answer. So Rav Soloveitchik says, to ask the question in terms of why God did something, the Holocaust, terrorism, whatever it is, we don't know. But halacha does not try to explain God. Halacha asks the question, what is my responsibility at any given moment in time? And for that, there is a meaningful answer. When a person is faced with all sorts of difficulties, a person asks, how can I take the darkness and make it light? How can I take the chaos and make it something of beauty? How can I grow from this? How can I help others? What can I do, to, as it were, to redeem the tragedy and somehow make meaning out of madness? That's a halachic, again, he doesn't mean halacha in the sense of the narrow word, halacha, but halachic in the sense of what is my obligation, as opposed to why God allowed something to happen. That is the idea of Maschilin Bignusa Messiah Bishvach. I'll just end with two stories that illustrate this. One involves a non-religious man, although he happens to be Jewish. I'm not sure if he's still alive anymore. There was a famous, or maybe there is a famous, classical pianist, Leon Fleischer. And in the 60s and 70s, he was really one of the most famous pianists in the world, very, very, very successful. But what happened was that he began to notice a repetitive stress injury in which he was not able to manipulate his fingers that well. And he went all over the world looking for treatments and nothing worked. And as a result, he had to give up playing. And Baruch Hashem, it's not terrorism, it's not death, but for a musician of his caliber, this was very, very traumatic. And in fact, he wanted to commit suicide, he said later. But eventually he got over it, and he basically said, if he cannot be a teacher, I'm sorry, if he cannot be a musician, he can at least be a teacher. And he got into a second career in the Peabody Institute in Baltimore, a very famous musical conservatory. He became one of the preeminent teachers of piano in the world, and many of the next generation of the great pianists are his proteges and the like, which is, okay, that's very, very nice. And he did this for around 25 years. After 25 years, his wife read that there's a new therapy being developed in Japan for deep tissue massage or whatever it is, and she wanted him to try it out. And he didn't want to do it. He said, listen, I don't want to get my hopes up. I've gotten used to this. I'm happy with this. If I get my hopes up that I'll go back to performing and it doesn't happen, I'm going to get suicidal again. But she convinced him. And lo and behold, a miracle happened that he was able to play. And he played, I think, for another 5 years. I think he came back eventually. But he got 5 years of playing in. Now, it's a nice story. But why am I telling you this? I'm telling you this because of something that he himself said afterwards. And again, he's not an observant Jew. But you see that the neshama of a Jew has such a holiness and connection with God. He said that when I was a performer, my life was all about me. What brought me glory? What brought me recognition? I lived for the applause. I lived for the acclaim of others. But God said, you're arrogant. You're conceited. I want you to learn to care about another person. I want you to rejoice in another person's successes. So I'm taking away your talent, and I'm forcing you to devote your life to making others look good. And Fleischer said, and that's what happened over many years, I began to rejoice in the successes of these students as much as my own success. And their triumphs were my triumphs. And their failures were my failures. And I cared about them even more than I cared about myself. And then God said, you've learned your lesson. You can have back your talents. Now, this is a neat story in the sense that it has an arc, albeit a 25-year arc. Many of our stories, many of our tragedies, may have a longer arc. We don't necessarily see the good end at the end. But we believe as a matter of emunah that even in those dark moments there is redemptive potential. I'll end with another story. Many of you probably have heard of Rav Yaakov Yosef Herman, who was Rabbi Scheinberg's father-in-law, Rebbetzin Scheinberg's father, and Ruchama Shein, again Zichrona Livracha, wrote a very, very great biography of her father called All for the Boss. Hakol Yadon Hakol in Hebrew, and it's filled with all sorts of interesting stories. What an amazing person he was! But one of the stories she tells about her father is that he came with his parents to the United States in the early 1900s, and his parents could not make a living here, so they went back to Europe and they left him alone in the United States. He was not even bar mitzvah yet. This is the way things were. I mean, this is not the only case. I mean, we can't even imagine those types of scenarios where little children were effectively left to fend. This is before there were child labor laws. Take care. So the first thing that happened was that Friday afternoon, his landlord raised the rent from $5 a month to $10 a month. And the kid couldn't afford it. He didn't have $10 a month to pay rent. So he was evicted Friday afternoon from this whatever room he was staying in. And he spent that first Friday night, this is the week his parents left, in Central Park. All he had were two little rolls with him. And he spent the night in Central Park. Now, Central Park was safer then than it later became, although now after Giuliani, Central Park is actually relatively safe, comparatively safe. And he was cold, he was afraid, he was frightened, he had no family. And what's going to happen next week? He'll get a job, and if you weren't to Shomer Shabbos, you likely lost the job next week anyway. He didn't know what he was going to do. He just didn't know what will happen to his life, what will happen to him. And that night, he prayed to Hashem the following. He said to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, please God, if you give me parnasa, and eventually if I have a shidduch who's even thinking that I have a family and I'm zocheh to establish a life, please don't let me forget all the feelings I have this night. Please let me remember what it's like to be cold and lonely and poor and friendless, so that when I encounter other people who are in that situation, I will remember what they went through. So what he asked God was, he should never forget the pain that he has. And if you know the rest of the book, you know that Baruch Hashem eventually, although he lost it in the Depression, but at least he became a successful businessman. He became fairly wealthy, well established. Then, of course, he spent many years in Eretz Yisrael afterwards. But the years of his prosperity and even the years of his poverty, he and his Rebbetzin always had many, many people over. And, of course, Baruch Hashem, he had his share of Gedolim and Rosh Hashivas. He was one of the few homes that the great Rosh Hashivas of Europe would be willing to eat at. But he didn't just have chashuva great people. He had many, many people who stayed for months at a time, who were homeless, who were mentally deranged, who were abusive, people that we would not enjoy in our own homes. Someone once poured hot cholent over him more than one time. They didn't like the food or whatever it was. And when someone said to him, how can you live with these crazy people? Why do you allow them to come into your home and stay for weeks or months at a time? He said he knows what they are feeling because he felt that way himself. And he asked Hashem to never let him forget the feelings of that night. And he says, and that gave him the source of his rachamim and compassion for all the people that were not necessarily the nicest, greatest people that we would like in our own home. So, b'kitzur, this is the yesod of maschil b'gnus u'mesayim b'shvach. Not simply remember the bad so that you appreciate the good, but to see even in the adversity the source of your rachamim and compassion and care for others, in which you can redeem tragedy even. You redeem the tragedy by reframing it, by redefining it, by using it as a positive source to achieve something in life that one would not have achieved without it. This is a very, very high madrega, and certainly we ask Hashem to spare us these difficulties, because who says we will rise to the occasion? That's a real question. But nevertheless, the potential is there, and Hashem's gifts sometimes come in terrifying, horrifying ways, to be sure. But within the horror and even the terror, there are going to be gifts that we have to look for in one way or the other to find some type of meaning in the difficulties of life. So, Yemodim L'Simcha. Right.